Well, good morning again.
Good morning.
We are, as I said, a week out from Easter. And I want us to take a step back for a second before we get to Thomas, who has a special place in my heart, and we'll talk about why in a minute. Because there are some issues that we have to deal with in terms of just the idea of resurrection. As Christians, for those of you who identify in such a way, which I suspect is most of you, the idea of Jesus being raised from the dead is just kind of a given. We're used to thinking about that. And yet, at the same time, we all know that dead people stay dead. That's how it works. Now, imagine for a second that by some weird accident of history in a parallel universe or something like that, the only surviving book from the New Testament is the letter to the Corinthians. Paul's writing to a church in Corinth, a very, very Greek city, Greek in like every sense of the word, and it's kind of like a wild place. Think elements of San Francisco mixed with elements of Las Vegas, Nevada, not New Mexico. And because there's a difference. And then you've got a feel for Corinth. And imagine, I don't know, archaeologists or whatever uncover this letter that for whatever reason has been preserved. Now, why 1 Corinthians? And it's because 1 Corinthians, there's a little bit of debate about this, is likely the first Christian writing, like historically, is the first work to be produced that talks about this idea of a guy named Jesus being raised from the dead. So the Gospels were written after Paul. Paul is the first one to put this idea on papyrus or whatever. And so imagine as historians, you get this book, you read it, it feels Jewish. Like he's talking about certain Jewish ideas, the only groups of people in the world at that time that had any idea about resurrection would be this fairly prominent group in Judea called the Pharisees. But otherwise, nobody in the world at that time believes that. And yet, this letter is written to obviously like very Greek people in a very Greek city. And yet, they have also attached themselves to a bunch of the Jewish narrative, but with this weird twist that somebody had been raised from the dead, and that idea that somebody in history is raised from the dead, apart from anybody else, and continues to live, is also a truly novel idea. As historians and archaeologists, you would say, what the heck happened? Because Judea is and Jerusalem especially is a long ways away from Corinth. Why do you have this Jewish writer writing to Gentiles talking? Huh. Now that is kind of the first step in a certain line of reasoning that argues that it's very hard to explain the emergence of Christianity without somebody actually being raised from the dead. And it's very sophisticated, but I think very cogent argument. But it is predicated on the fact that everybody knows that dead people stay dead. They don't come back. Now, with that in mind, let's go to Thomas. I really like Thomas. Thomas sometimes gets a bad rap. Yes, he's called Doubting Thomas because he did, in fact, doubt. But I think there's more to it than that. Sometimes he gets cast as like somebody who's very practically minded, who wants demonstration, wants practical proof. So sometimes people think, oh, he's an engineer or something like that. If you know, you know. But I don't think that's what's going on at all. I think Thomas's reaction is better explained through the lens of just like emotional trauma, essentially. The first thing we notice is that Thomas is not with the other disciples. The other disciples, they are hiding. John says for fear of the Jews. John is maddening like that because he just uses like very, very collective words and then he expects us to figure out whom. They weren't afraid of like, you know, Joseph down the street or whatever. They were afraid of leadership, really the temple leadership. Because if their leader got the axe, they know that they're next. So they're hiding for their own safety and out of fear. Where's Thomas? He's not there. As far as we know, he's not from Jerusalem. So does he have like a cousin there? I mean, maybe. Or is he just distraught after this guy that he had been following for 3 years died a very horrifying death, and he thought he was the one to bring about the consolation of Israel, like the one that they've been waiting for, God's Messiah. And now that he's dead, he obviously isn't, so who cares? Now, some of that is speculation, but I think it's very much within the realm of possibility. And at the very least, we have the image of somebody who is very much separated from his brothers. We could speculate further on why, but we'll just leave it at that. So Jesus appears to his disciples, peace be with you. In my own imagination, that's, hey, calm down. Because seeing somebody that you knew to be dead standing in front of you, I promise you, would not be a comfortable experience. I'm kind of imagining like people that I've known and loved very much who have died. If they walked into this room right now, my first instinct would not be joy. It wouldn't. Thank you for laughing, Kelly. No, but, I've probably said this before, I had a funeral of an older gentleman in my first congregation who had died, and I was not aware for whatever reason that he had a brother who was the spitting image of him. And I will never forget when he walked into the sanctuary for the first time and I looked and did a... I felt it. It was very, very uncomfortable. So, Jesus appears. Slow down, guys. Peace be with you. Now, he shows them his scars, and I think that's both Jesus' action, but it's also John very subtly saying that when we are talking about resurrection, we mean bodies. This is not a spiritual experience. You can have those whenever. This is a physical, visceral. And it has a profound continuity with Jesus' physicality and his body from before. So it's really him. Now, he says all this, and he gives them the Holy Spirit. That's kind of John's compressed way of maybe talking about or looking ahead to Pentecost. That's a whole other conversation. And then he leaves. A week later, Thomas has made his way back. Again, we don't know the circumstances. We don't know if he was finally like found where they were hiding. Maybe they scattered. Well, we know that a lot of them scattered. Who knows? It's not worth speculating. But he has found his way back. Now, imagine somebody that you knew and loved who has passed. And then you walk into a room of your friends or family or whomever, and they say, "We've seen him." How would you respond? It would not be joy. It wouldn't even be amusement. I mean, if a group of my friends got together and said, "Hey, Kyle's back, he's alive now," or my grandparents, they're back, I'd be angry. I would think that there's something wrong with them. And I think Thomas's reaction is 100% justified. And I think his reaction is also a little more intense than it may come out to be in English. Because he's saying, like, unless I, you know, put my hand in his side or whatever. And the language he uses there is actually pretty aggressive. It's often reserved for, like, the context of weapons. Like, if the Greek word is balo, it's like thrust or something like that. It's, you'd use that with a spear or something. So he's like, look, unless I thrust my hand in his side. And then he says, hey, me pistoso, I will continue not believing. These are the words of somebody who's angry. And anger is very much part of the reaction of grief. If you've lost somebody, you know what it means to be angry at some point in that process. And so, as Thomas is, you know, said, look, unless I thrust my hand in his side, no, I don't buy it. Now, he's not being practical, he's being grief-stricken. He's being traumatized. Modern language, we'd say he's being gaslit, because you get a bunch of people saying, hey, that guy that we all knew and loved who died, and some of us saw him die, he's alive again. Dead people stay dead. That's how it works. Now, Jesus appears to him. And rather than, you know, shaming him or shaking his head at him or anything like that, he just gives him what he needs. This is not practically minded either. If, again, running with the metaphor, somebody that you had lost is now standing in front of you, aside from the initial shock, what's your next question? Is it really you? Because this is an unsettling, uncomfortable moment. So, huh. Now, Jesus' scarring would be unique. The process of crucifixion is pretty unmistakable. And so the scars that it would leave would be quite obvious. Granted, you'd tend not to survive that. And then Thomas says, my Lord, my God. Now, what Thomas is dealing with here is in some sense something I might call like the trauma of resurrection. And I talked about this a little bit last week for Easter, is what would actually happen if everything sad became untrue, to use the words of J.R.R. Tolkien. It would not be comfortable. In fact, it would be in some ways kind of terrifying, because, and I touched on this a little bit last week, you now have to reorient everything you know about life, because one of the most fundamental laws, being dead people stay dead, is now in at least one case untrue. And what this then invites is this very uncomfortable and in a lot of ways very vulnerable idea that maybe there is actually hope for us yet. If you've never heard of the term nihilism, nihilism is very much endemic within our culture. Nihilism is the idea that everything goes to nothing anyway. Nothing ultimately matters. We're all going to die. Who cares? And whether we recognize it or not, there is a sense in which, even for believers, we will constantly struggle with this idea of, oh, who cares? This is like, or, hey, do you really want to go skydiving? And then your response might be, well, it's not like I'm going to live forever, or something like that. Or, why don't we do this anyway? Life's short. Like, you say these things, and deep down inside, there's this recognition that we're all going to die anyway, so who cares? Might as well get whatever I can out of life before I'm dirt. Resurrection invites us to rethink that. And learning to have hope that, in fact, if God can raise the dead, if God can redeem Jesus' death, and by doing that in a very weird and ironic way, he is redeeming us. And if God can redeem that and defeat death in one fell swoop, then maybe God can redeem anything? Maybe he can redeem suffering? All suffering? Maybe he can redeem the worst parts of you, the parts of you that deep down in your heart you are convinced will never change. That is an uncomfortable proposition because we tend to get used to it. And whenever we have to rethink and relive and re-understand something that we're, it may not be great, but we're at least used to it and it's familiar, we may experience Thomas's anger, which would lead me to a question. What, within your own life, if you had learned that it is actually redeemable, what about you that you just hate? We all have things about us that we hate. It's called being human. What if actually God had a redemptive plan for that? What if you are actually forgiven? And beyond that, what if God is actively working on transforming that part of you? What then? To which I would say, notice Jesus' tender, compassionate response. You're the scars, it's really me. Then Thomas, of course, then says, my Lord and my God, which is the most concise, most direct confession of who Jesus actually is. The guy who is angry, doubting Thomas, however we want to call him, out of his mouth comes the most concise confession of Jesus. That tracks. And I'll leave you with this. Jesus, of course, famously says, you see and you believe. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Now, let's go back to where we started, thinking historically. John, the gospel, is, it's almost universally agreed, he is written very late. New Testament's got, like, we love to argue about this. He's definitely the latest gospel. Definitely written almost certainly after the, certainly after the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. Long after Paul has died. Highly likely long after Peter is dead. We know at least one of the Jameses has died. And in fact, it's probably written around the time when that first generation of Christians, the ones who have actually seen Jesus resurrected, are now starting to die. And imagine you're part of that part of this community that is reading this Gospel of John for the first time, and you knew some people who knew some of those people who were there, and you have heard through the grapevine or whatever the Mediterranean, I guess they grow grapes there, so yeah, through the grapevine, that, oh, Bartholomew died. Oh, Andrew died. Oh, you know, you start getting word that some of those first people to see the resurrected Jesus in person have now passed. These would be your heroes, really. And then you hear Jesus' words, "Blessed are those who believe even though they haven't seen." You would say, "Oh, he's writing to me." Well, the same is true today. If you're here and you believe, Jesus has blessed you. By the power of the Spirit, you believe, and so may you endure the trauma of hope. The trauma of asking, how is God either redeeming or going to redeem the part of me that I just assumed is irredeemable? Because that's resurrection. Amen.